fast for their eyes. I remember that by the time I stopped I was weak and sick, and my veins were burning as if I were starved. I thought of killing, and the thought filled me with revulsion. I was sitting on the stone steps beside a church, at one of those small side doors, carved into the stone which was bolted and locked for the night. The rain had abated, or so it seemed, and the street was dreary and quiet, though a man passed a long way off with a bright black umbrella. Armand stood at a distance under the trees. Behind him it seemed there was a great expanse of trees and wet grasses and mist rising as if the ground were warm. By thinking of only one thing, the sickness in my stomach and head and the tightening in my throat, was I able to return to a state of calm. By the time these things had died away and I was feeling clear again, I was aware of all that had happened. The great distance we'd come from the theatre, and that the remains of Madeline and Claudia were still there. Victims of a holocaust in each other's arms. And I felt resolute and very near to my own destruction. "I could not prevent it," Armand said softly to me, and I looked up to see his face unutterably sad. He looked away from me, as if he felt it was futile to try to convince me of this, and I could feel his overwhelming sadness, his near defeat. I had the feeling that if I were to vent all my anger on him, he would do little to resist me. And I could feel that detachment, the passivity in him as something pervasive, which was at the root of what he insisted to me again. I could not have prevented it. "Oh, but you could have prevented it," I said softly. "You know full well that you could have. You were the leader. You were the only one who knew the limits of your own power. They didn't know. They didn't understand. Your understanding surpassed theirs." He looked away still, but I could see the effect of my words on him. I could see the weariness in his face, the dull, lusterless sadness of his eyes. "You held sway over them. They feared you," I went on. "You could have stopped them if you'd been willing to use that power even beyond your own self-prescribed limits. It was your sense of yourself you would not violate, your own precious conception of truth. I understand you perfectly. I see in you the reflection of myself." His eyes moved gently to engage mine, but he said nothing. The pain of his face was terrible. It was softened and desperate with pain, and on the verge of some terrible, explicit emotion he would not be able to control. He was in fear of that emotion. I was not. He was feeling my pain with that great, spellbinding power of his which surpassed mine. I was not feeling his pain. It did not matter to me. "I understand you only too well," I said. "That passivity in me has been the core of it all, the real evil. That weakness, that refusal to compromise a fractured and stupid morality, that awful pride. For that, I let myself become the thing I am when I knew it was wrong. For that, I let Claudia become the vampire she became when I knew it was wrong. For that, I stood by and let her kill Lestat when I knew that was wrong, the very thing that was her undoing. I lifted not a finger to prevent it. And Madeleine? Madeleine, I let her come to that, when I should never have made her a creature like ourselves. I knew that was wrong. Well, I tell you I am no longer that passive, weak creature that has spun evil from evil till the web is vast and thick, while I remain its stultified victim. It's over. I know now what I must do. And I warn you, for whatever mercy you've shown me in digging me out of that grave tonight where I would have died, do not seek your cell in the Théâtre des Vampires again. Do not go near it." I didn't wait to hear his answer. Perhaps he never attempted one, I don't know. I left him without looking back. If he followed me, I was not conscious of it. I did not seek to know. I did not care. It was to the cemetery in Montmartre that I retreated. Why that place, I'm not certain, except that it wasn't far from the Boulevard des Capucines, and Montmartre was countrified then and dark and peaceful compared to the metropolis. Wandering among the low houses with their kitchen gardens, I killed without the slightest measure of satisfaction, and then sought out the coffin where I was to lie by day in the cemetery. I scraped the remains out of it with my bare hands, and lay down to a bed of foulness, of damp, of the stench of death. I cannot say this gave me comfort. Rather, it gave me what I wanted. Closeted in that dark, smelling the earth, away from all humans and all living human forms, I gave myself over to everything that invaded and stifled my senses, and, in so doing, gave myself over to my grief. But that was short. When the cold grey winter sun had set the next night, I was awake, feeling the tingling numbness leave me soon as it does in winter, feeling the dark, living things that inhabited the coffin scurrying around me, fleeing my resurrection. I emerged slowly under the faint moon, savouring the coldness, the utter smoothness of the marble slab I shifted to escape. And, wandering out of the graves and out of the cemetery, I went over a plan in my mind, a plan on which I was willing to gamble my life with the powerful freedom of a being who truly does not care for that life, who has the extraordinary strength of being willing to die. In a kitchen garden I saw something, something that had only been vague in my thoughts until I had my hands on it. It was a small scythe, its sharp, curved blade still caked with green weeds from the last mowing, and once I'd wiped it clean and run my finger along the sharp blade, it was as if my plan came clear to me, and I could move fast to my other errands, the getting of a carriage and a driver who could do my bidding for days, dazzled by the cash I gave him and the promises of more, the removing of my chest from the Hotel Saint-Gabriel to the inside of that carriage, and the procuring of all the other things which I needed. And then there were the long hours of the night, when I could pretend to drink with my driver, and talk with him, and obtain his expensive cooperation in driving me at dawn from Paris to Fontainebleau. I slept within the carriage, where my delicate health required I not be disturbed under any circumstances, this privacy being so important that I was more than willing to add a generous sum to the amount I was already paying him simply for his not touching even the door-handle of the carriage until I emerged from it. And when I was convinced he was in agreement and quite drunk enough to be oblivious to almost everything but the gathering up of the reins for the journey to Fontainebleau, we drove slowly, cautiously into the street of the Théâtre des Vampires and waited some distance away for the sky to begin to grow light. The theatre was shut up and locked against the coming day. I crept towards it when the air and the light told me I had at most 15 minutes to execute my plan. I knew that, closeted far within, the vampires of the theatre were in their coffins already, and that even if one late vampire lingered on the verge of going to bed, he would not hear these first preparations. Quickly, I put pieces of wood against the bolted doors. Quickly I drove in the nails, which then locked these doors from the outside. A passer-by took some note of what I did, but went on, believing me perhaps to be boarding up the establishment with the authority of the owner. I didn't know. I did know, however, that before I was finished I might encounter those ticket-sellers, those ushers, those men who swept up after, and might well remain inside to guard the vampires in their daily sleep. It was of those men I was thinking as I led the carriage up to Armand's alley, and left it there, taking with me 2 small barrels of kerosene to Armand's door. The key admitted me easily as I'd hoped, and once inside the lower passage I opened the door of his cell to find he was not there. The coffin was gone. In fact, everything was gone but the furnishings, including the dead boy's enclosed bed. Hastily I opened one barrel, and, rolling the other before me towards the stairs, I hurried along, splashing the exposed beams with kerosene and flinging it on the wooden doors of the other cells. The smell of it was strong, stronger and more powerful than any sound I might have made to alert anyone. And though I stood stark still at the stairs with the barrels and the scythe, listening, I heard nothing. Nothing of those guards I presumed to be there. Nothing of the vampires themselves. And clutching the handle of the scythe, I ventured slowly upwards until I stood in the door of the ballroom. No one was there to see me splash the kerosene on the horsehair chairs, or on the draperies, or to see me hesitate just for an instant at that doorway of the small yard where Madeleine and Claudia had been killed. Oh, how I wanted to open that door! It so tempted me that for a minute I almost forgot my plan. I almost dropped the barrels and turned the knob, but I could see the light through the cracks of the old wood of the door, and I knew I had to go on. Madeleine and Claudia were not there. They were dead. And what would I have done had I opened that doorway, had I been confronted again with those remains, that matted, dishevelled, golden hair? And there was no time, no purpose. I was running through dark corridors I hadn't explored before, bathing old wooden doors with the kerosene, certain that the vampires lay closeted within, rushing on cat feet into the theatre itself, where a cold grey light seeping from the bolted front entrance sped me on to fling a dark stain across the great velvet stage curtain, the padded chairs, the draperies of the lobby doors. And finally the barrel was empty and thrown away. And I was pulling out the crude torch I'd made, putting my match to its kerosene-drenched rags and setting the chairs alight, the flames licking their thick silk and padding as I ran towards the stage and sent the fire rushing up that dark curtain into a cold, sucking draught. In seconds, the theatre blazed as with the light of day, and the whole frame of it seemed to creak and groan as the fire roared up the walls, licking the great proscenium arch, the plaster curlicues of the overhanging boxes. But I had no time to admire it, to savour the smell and the sound of it, the sight of the nooks and crannies coming to light in the fierce illumination that would soon consume them. I was fleeing to the lower floor again, thrusting the torch into the horsehair couch of the ballroom, into the curtains, into anything that would burn. Someone thundered on the boards above, in rooms I'd never seen. And then I heard the unmistakable opening of a door. But it was too late, I told myself, gripping both the scythe and the torch. The building was alight. They would be destroyed. I ran for the stairs, a distant cry rising over the crackling and roaring of the flames, my torch scraping the kerosene-soaked rafters above me, the flames enveloping the old wood, curling against the damp ceiling. It was Santiago's cry, I was sure of it, and then as I hit the lower floor, I saw him above, behind me, coming down the stairs, the smoke filling the stairwell around him, his eyes watering, his throat thickened with his choking, his hand out towards me as he stammered, "You! You! Damn you!" And I froze, narrowing my eyes against the smoke, feeling the water rising in them, burning in them, but never letting go of his image for an instant, the vampire using all his power now to fly at me with such speed that he would become invisible. And as the dark thing that was his clothes rushed down, I swung the scythe and saw it strike his neck and felt the weight of his neck and saw him fall sideways, both hands reaching for the appalling wound. The air was full of cries, of screams, and a white face loomed above Santiago, a mask of terror. Some other vampire ran through the passage ahead of me towards that secret alleyway door, but I stood there poised, staring at Santiago, seeing him rise despite the wound. And I swung the scythe again, catching him easily. And there was no wound, just two hands, groping for a head that was no longer there. And the head, blood coursing from the torn neck, the eyes staring wild under the flaming rafters, the dark, silky hair matted and wet with blood fell at my feet. I struck it hard with my boot, I sent it flying along the passage, and I ran after it, the torch and the scythe thrown aside as my arms went up to protect me from the blaze of white light that flooded the stairs to the alley. The rain descended in shimmering needles into my eyes, eyes that squinted to see the dark outline of the carriage flicker against the sky. The slumped driver straightened at my hoarse command, his clumsy hand going instinctively for the whip, and the carriage lurched as I pulled open the door, the horses driving forward fast as I grappled with the lid of the chest, my body thrown roughly to one side, my burnt hands slipping down into the cold, protecting silk, the lid coming down into concealing darkness. The pace of the horses increased, driving away from the corner of the burning building. Yet I could still smell the smoke. It choked me. It burnt my eyes and my lungs, even as my hands were burnt and my forehead was burnt from the first diffused light of the sun. But we were driving on, away from the smoke and the cries. We were leaving Paris. I had done it. The Théâtre des Vampires was burning to the ground. And as I felt my head fall back, I saw Claudia and Madeleine again in one another's arms in that grim yard, and I said to them softly, bending down to the soft heads of hair that glistened in the candlelight, "I couldn't take you away. I couldn't take you. But they will lie ruined and dead all around you. If the fire doesn't consume them, it will be the sun. If they are not burnt out, then it will be the people who will come to fight the fire, who will find them and expose them to the light of day. But I promise you, they will all die as you have died. Everyone who was closeted there this dawn will die. And they are the only deaths I have caused in my long life, which are both exquisite and good." Two nights later I returned. I had to see that rain-flooded cellar, where every brick was scorched, crumbling, where a few skeletal rafters jabbed at the sky like stakes. Those monstrous murals that once enclosed the ballroom were blasted fragments in the rubble, a painted face here, a patch of angel's wing there, the only identifiable things that remained. With the evening newspapers I pushed my way to the back of a crowded little theatre café across the street, and there, under the cover of the dim gas lamps and thick cigar smoke, I read the accounts of the Holocaust. Few bodies were found in the burnt-out theatre, but clothing and costumes had been scattered everywhere, as though the famous vampire mummers had in fact vacated the theatre in haste long before the fire. In other words, only the younger vampires had left their bones. The ancient ones had suffered total obliteration. No mention of an eyewitness or a surviving victim. How could there have been? Yet something bothered me considerably. I did not fear any vampires who had escaped. I had no desire to hunt them out if they had. That most of the crew had died, I was certain. But why had there been no human guards? I was certain Santiago had mentioned guards, and I supposed them to be the ushers and doormen who staffed the theatre before the performance. And I had even been prepared to encounter them with my scythe, but they had not been there. It was strange, and my mind was not entirely comfortable with the strangeness. But, finally, when I put the papers aside and sat thinking these things over, the strangeness of it didn't matter. What mattered was that I was more utterly alone in the world than I had ever been in all my life, that Claudia was gone beyond reprieve, and I had less reason to live than I'd ever had, and less desire. And yet my sorrow did not overwhelm me, did not actually visit me, did not make of me the racked and desperate creature I might have expected to become. Perhaps it was not possible to sustain the torment I'd experienced when I saw Claudia's burnt remains. Perhaps it was not possible to know that and exist over any period of time. I wondered vaguely, as the hours passed, as the smoke of the café grew thicker and the faded curtain of the little lamp-lit stage rose and fell, and robust women sang there, the light glittering on their paste jewels, their rich, soft voices often plaintive, exquisitely sad. I wondered, vaguely, what it would be to feel this loss, this outrage, and be justified in it, be deserving of sympathy, of solace. I would not have told my woe to a living creature. My own tears meant nothing to me. Where to go, then, if not to die? It was strange how the answer came to me. Strange how I wandered out of the café then, circling the ruined theatre, wandering finally towards the broad Avenue Napoléon, and following it towards the Palace of the Louvre. It was as if that place called to me. And yet I had never been inside its walls. I'd passed its long façade 1,000 times, wishing that I could live as a mortal man for one day, to move through those many rooms, and to see those many magnificent paintings. I was bent on it now, possessed only of some vague notion that in works of art I could find some solace while bringing nothing of death to what was inanimate and yet magnificently possessed of the spirit of life itself. Somewhere along the Avenue Napoléon, I heard the step behind me which I knew to be Armand's. He was signalling, letting me know that he was near. Yet I did nothing other than slow my pace and let him fall into step with me, and for a long while we walked, saying nothing. I dared not look at him. Of course, I'd been thinking of him all the while, and how if we were men and Claudia had been my love, I might have fallen helpless in his arms, finally, the need to share some common grief so strong, so consuming. The dam threatened to break now, and yet it did not break. I was numbed, and I walked as one numbed. "You know what I've done," I said finally. We had turned off the avenue, and I could see ahead of me the long row of double columns on the façade of the Royal Museum. "You removed your coffin as I warned you." "Yes," he answered. There was a sudden, unmistakable comfort in the sound of his voice. It weakened me, but I was simply too remote from pain, too tired. "And yet you are here with me now. Do you mean to avenge them?" "No," he said. "They were your fellows. You were their leader," I said. "Yet you didn't warn them I was out for them, as I warned you?" "No," he said. "But surely you despise me for it? Surely you respect some rule, some allegiance to your own kind?" "No," he said softly. It was amazing to me how logical his response was, even though I couldn't explain it or understand it. And something came clear to me out of the remote regions of my own relentless considerations. There were guards. There were those ushers who slept in the theatre. Why weren't they there when I entered? Why weren't they there to protect the sleeping vampires? "Because they were in my employ, and I discharged them. I sent them away," Armand said. I stopped. He showed no concern at my facing him, and as soon as our eyes met I wished the world were not one black, empty ruin of ashes and death. I wished it were fresh and beautiful, and that we were both living and had love to give each other. "You did this, knowing what I planned to do?"
"Yes," he said.
"But you were their leader. They trusted you. They believed in you. They lived with you," I said. "I don't understand you. Why—"
"Think of any answer you like," he said calmly and sensitively, as if he didn't wish to bruise me with any accusation or disdain, but wanted me merely to consider this literally. "I can think of many. Think of the one you need and believe it. It's as likely as any other. I shall give you the real reason for what I did, which is the least true. I was leaving Paris. The theatre belonged to me. So I discharged them. But with what you knew, I told you. It was the actual reason, and it was the least true, he said patiently.
Would you destroy me as easily as you let them be destroyed? I demanded.
Why should I? He asked.
My God, I whispered.
You're much changed, he said. But in a way, you are much the same.
I walked on for a while, and then, before the entrance to the Louvre, I stopped. At first it seemed to me that its many windows were dark and silver with the moonlight and the thin rain, but then I thought I saw a faint light moving within, as though a guard walked among the treasures. I envied him completely, and I fixed my thoughts on him obdurately, that guard, calculating how a vampire might get to him, how take his life and his lantern and his keys. The plan was confusion. I was incapable of plans. I had made only one real plan in my life, and it was finished. And then finally I surrendered. I turned to Armand again, and let my eyes penetrate his eyes, and let him draw close to me as if he meant to make me his victim, and I bowed my head, and felt his firm arm around my shoulder. And, remembering suddenly and keenly Claudia's words, what were very nearly her last words, that admission that she knew that I could love Armand because I had been able to love even her, those words struck me as rich and ironical, more filled with meaning than she could have guessed. Yes, I said softly to him, that is the crowning evil, that we can even go so far as to love each other, you and I. And who else would show us a particle of love, a particle of compassion or mercy? Who else, knowing us as we know each other, could do anything but destroy us? Yet we can love each other. And for a long moment he stood there looking at me, drawing nearer, his head gradually inclining to one side, his lips parted as if he meant to speak, but then he only smiled and shook his head gently to confess he didn't understand. But I wasn't thinking of him any more. I had one of those rare moments when it seemed I thought of nothing. My mind had no shape. I saw that the rain had stopped. I saw that the air was clear and cold, that the street was luminous. And I wanted to enter the Louvre. I formed words to tell Armand this, to ask him if he might help me do what was necessary to have the Louvre till dawn. He thought it a very simple request. He said only he wondered why I had waited so long. We left Paris very soon after that. I told Armand that I wanted to return to the Mediterranean, not to Greece as I had so long dreamed. I wanted to go to Egypt. I wanted to see the desert there, and more importantly, I wanted to see the pyramids and the graves of the kings. I wanted to make contact with those grave thieves who know more about the graves than do scholars. And I wanted to go down into the graves yet unopened and see the kings as they were buried, see those furnishings and works of art stored with them and the paintings on their walls. Armand was more than willing, and we took leave of Paris early one evening by carriage without the slightest hint of ceremony. I had done one thing which I should note. I had gone back to my rooms in the Hotel Saint-Gabriel. It was my purpose to take up some things of Claudia and Madeleine and put them into coffins, and have graves prepared for them in the cemetery of Montmartre. I did not do this. I stayed a short while in the rooms, where all was neat and put right by the staff, so that it seemed Madeleine and Claudia might return at any time. Madeleine's embroidery ring lay with her bundles of thread on a chair-side table. I looked at that, and at everything else, and my task seemed meaningless, so I left. But something had occurred to me there. Or rather, something I had already been aware of merely became clearer. I had gone to the Louvre that night to lay down my soul,
to find some transcendent pleasure that would obliterate pain and make me utterly forget even myself. I'd been upheld in this. As I stood on the sidewalk before the doors of the hotel, waiting for the carriage that would take me to meet Armand, I saw the people who walked there, the restless boulevard crowd of well-dressed ladies and gentlemen, the hawkers of papers, the carriers of luggage, the drivers of carriages, all these in a new light. Before, all art had held for me the promise of a deeper understanding of the human heart. Now the human heart meant nothing. I did not denigrate it. I simply forgot it. The magnificent paintings of the Louvre were not for me intimately connected with the hands that had painted them. They were cut loose and dead like children turned to stone, like Claudia, severed from her mother, preserved for decades in pearl and hammered gold, like Madeleine's dolls. And of course, like Claudia and Madeleine and myself, they could all be reduced to ashes. Part 4. And that is the end of the story, really. Of course, I know you wonder what happened to us afterwards. What became of Armand? Where did I go? What did I do? But I tell you, nothing really happened. Nothing that wasn't merely inevitable. And my journey through the Louvre that last night I've described to you, that was merely prophetic. I never changed after that. I sought for nothing in the one great source of change which is humanity. And even in my love and absorption with the beauty of the world, I sought to learn nothing that could be given back to humanity. I drank of the beauty of the world as a vampire drinks. I was satisfied. I was filled to the brim, but I was dead, and I was changeless. The story ended in Paris, as I've said. For a long time I thought that Claudia's death had been the cause of the end of things, that if I had seen Madeleine and Claudia leave Paris safely, things might have been different with me and Armand. I might have loved again, and desired again, and sought some semblance of mortal life which would have been rich and varied, though unnatural. But now I have come to see that was false. Even if Claudia had not died, even if I had not despised Armand for letting her die, it would have all turned out the same. Coming slowly to know his evil, or being catapulted into it, was all the same. I wanted none of it, finally. And deserving nothing better, I closed up like a spider in the flame of a match. And even Armand, who was my constant companion, and my only companion, existed at a great distance from me, beyond that veil which separated me from all living things, a veil which was a form of shroud. But I know you are eager to hear what became of Armand. And the night is almost ended. I want to tell you this because it is very important. The story is incomplete without it. We traveled the world after we left Paris, as I've told you. First Egypt, then Greece, then Italy, Asia Minor. Wherever I chose to lead us, really, and wherever my pursuit of art led me. Time ceased to exist on any meaningful basis during these years, and I was often absorbed in very simple things— a painting in a museum, a cathedral window, one single beautiful statue for long periods of time. But all during these years I had a vague but persistent desire to return to New Orleans. I never forgot New Orleans. And when we were in tropical places and places of those flowers and trees that grow in Louisiana, I would think of it acutely, and I would feel for my home the only glimmer of desire I felt for anything outside my endless pursuit of art. And from time to time Armand would ask me to take him there, and I, being aware in a gentlemanly manner that I did little to please him and often went for long periods without really speaking to him or seeking him out, wanted to do this because he asked me. It seemed his asking caused me to forget some vague fear that I might feel pain in New Orleans, that I might experience again the pale shadow of my former unhappiness and longing. But I put it off. Perhaps the fear was stronger than I knew. We came to America, and lived in New York for a long time. I continued to put it off. Then, finally, Armand urged me in another way. He told me something he'd concealed from me since the time we were in Paris. Lestat had not died in the Théâtre des Vampires. I had believed him to be dead, and when I asked Armand about those vampires, he told me they all had perished. But he told me now that this wasn't so. Lestat had left the theatre the night I had run away from Armand, and sought out the cemetery in Montmartre. Two vampires who had been made with Lestat by the same master had assisted him in booking passage to New Orleans. I cannot convey to you the feeling that came over me when I heard this. Of course, Armand told me he had protected me from this knowledge, hoping that I would not undertake a long journey merely for revenge, a journey that would have caused me pain and grief at the time. But I didn't really care. I hadn't thought of Lestat at all the night I torched the theatre. I'd thought of Santiago and Celeste and the others who had destroyed Claudia. Lestat, in fact, had aroused in me feelings which I hadn't wished to confide in anyone, feelings I'd wished to forget, despite Claudia's death. Hatred had not been one of them. But when I heard this now from Armand, it was as if the veil that protected me were thin and transparent, and though it still hung between me and the world of feeling, I perceived through it Lestat, and that I wanted to see him again. And with that spurring me on, we returned to New Orleans. It was late spring of this year, and as soon as I emerged from the railway station, I knew that I had indeed come home. It was as if the very air were perfumed and peculiar there, and I felt an extraordinary ease walking on those warm, flat pavements, under those familiar oaks, and listening to the ceaseless, vibrant, living sounds of the night. Of course, New Orleans was changed, but far from lamenting those changes, I was grateful for what seemed still the same. I could find in the uptown garden district, which had been in my time the Faubourg Saint-Marie, one of the stately old mansions that dated back to those times, so removed from the quiet brick street that, walking out in the moonlight under its magnolia trees, I knew the same sweetness and peace I'd known in the old days. Not only in the dark, narrow streets of the Vieux Carré, but in the wilderness of Pointe du Lac. There were the honeysuckle and the roses, and a glimpse of Corinthian columns against the stars. And outside the gate were dreamy streets, other mansions. It was a citadel of grace. In the Rue Royale, where I took Armand past tourists and antique shops, and the bright-lit entrances of fashionable restaurants, I was astonished to discover the townhouse where Lestat and Claudia and I had made our home. The façade, little changed by fresh plaster, and whatever repairs had been done within. Its two French windows still opened onto the small balconies over the shop below, and I could see in the soft brilliance of the electric chandeliers an elegant wallpaper that would not have been unfamiliar in those days before the war. I had a strong sense of Lestat there, more of a sense of him than of Claudia, and I felt certain, though he was nowhere near this town house, that I'd find him in New Orleans. And I felt something else. It was a sadness that came over me then, after Armand had gone on his way. But this sadness was not painful, nor was it passionate. It was something rich, however, and almost sweet, like the fragrance of the jasmine and the roses that crowded the old courtyard garden, which I saw through the iron gates. And this sadness gave a subtle satisfaction, and held me a long time in that spot. And it held me to the city. And he didn't really leave me that night when I went away. I wonder now what might have come of this sadness, what it might have engendered in me that could have become stronger than itself. But I jump ahead of my story, because shortly after that I saw a vampire in New Orleans, a sleek, white-faced young man walking alone on the broad sidewalks of St. Charles Avenue in the early hours before dawn. And I was at once convinced that if Lestat still lived here, that vampire might know him, and might even lead me to him. Of course, the vampire didn't see me. I had long ago learned to spot my own kind in large cities without their having a chance to see me. Armand, in his brief visits with vampires in London and Rome, had learned that the burning of the Théâtre des Vampires was known throughout the world, and that both of us were considered outcasts. Battles over this meant nothing to me, and I have avoided them to this day. But I began to watch for this vampire in New Orleans and to follow him, though often he led me merely to theatres or other pastimes in which I had no interest. But one night, finally, things changed. It was a very warm evening, and I could tell as soon as I saw him on St. Charles that he had some place to go. He was not only walking fast, but he seemed a little distressed. And when he turned off St. Charles finally on a narrow street which became at once shabby and dark, I felt sure he was headed for something that would interest me. But then he entered one side of a small wooden duplex and brought death to a woman there. This he did very fast, without a trace of pleasure. And after he was finished, he gathered her child up from the bassinet, wrapped it gently in a blue wool blanket, and came out again into the street. Only a block or two after that, he stopped before a vine-covered iron fence that enclosed a large, overgrown yard. I could see an old house beyond the trees, dark, the paint peeling, the ornate iron railings of its long upper and lower galleries caked with orange rust. It seemed a doomed house, stranded here among the numerous small wooden houses, its high, empty windows looking out on what must have been a dismal clutter of low roofs, a corner grocery, and a small adjacent bar. But the broad, dark grounds protected the house somewhat from these things, and I had to move along the fence quite a few feet before I finally spotted a faint glimmer in one of the lower windows through the thick branches of the trees. The vampire had gone through the gate. I could hear the baby wailing. And then nothing. And I followed, easily mounting the old fence and dropping down into the garden and coming up quietly onto the long front porch. It was an amazing sight I saw when I crept up to one of the long floor-length windows. For despite the heat of this breezeless evening when the gallery, even with its warped and broken boards, might have been the only tolerable place for human or vampire, a fire blazed in the grate of the parlour, and all its windows were shut, and a young vampire sat by the fire talking to another vampire who hovered very near it, his slippered feet right up against the hot grate, his trembling fingers pulling over and over at the lapels of his shabby blue robe. And, though a frayed electric cord dangled from a plaster wreath of roses in the ceiling, only an oil lamp added its dim light to the fire. An oil lamp which stood by the wailing child on a nearby table. My eyes widened as I studied this stooped and shivering vampire, whose rich blonde hair hung down in loose waves covering his face. I longed to wipe away the dust on the window glass, which would not let me be certain of what I suspected. "You all leave me," he whined now in a thin, high-pitched voice. "You can't keep us with you," said the stiff young vampire sharply. He sat with his legs crossed, his arms folded on his narrow chest, his eyes looking around the dusty, empty room disdainfully. "Oh, hush," he said to the baby, who let out a sharp cry. "Stop it, stop it."
They would,"
said the blonde vampire feebly, and as he motioned to the other to hand him the fuel by his chair, I saw clearly, unmistakably, the profile of Lestat, that smooth skin now devoid of even the faintest trace of his old scars. "If you just go out," said the other angrily, heaving a chunk of wood into the blaze, "if you just hunt something other than these miserable animals," and he looked about himself in disgust. I saw then, in the shadows, the small furry bodies of several cats lying helter-skelter in the dust. A most remarkable thing. because a vampire can no more endure to be near his dead victims than any mammal can remain near any place where he has left his waste.
"Do you know that it's summer?" demanded the young one.
Lestat merely rubbed his hands.
The baby's howling died off, yet the young vampire added, "Get on with it, take it so you'll be warm."
"You might have brought me something else," said Lestat bitterly.
And as he looked at the baby, I saw his eyes squinting against the dull light of the smoky lamp. I felt a shock of recognition at those eyes, even at the expression beneath the shadow of the deep wave of his yellow hair. And yet to hear that whining voice, to see that bent and quivering back, almost without thinking I rapped hard on the glass. The young vampire was up at once, affecting a hard, vicious expression, and I merely motioned for him to turn the latch. And Lestat, clutching his bathrobe to his throat, rose from the chair.
"It's Louis! Louis!" he said. "Let him in!"
And he gestured frantically like an invalid for the young nurse to obey. As soon as the window opened, I breathed the stench of the room and its sweltering heat. The swarming of the insects on the rotted animals scratched at my senses so that I recoiled despite myself, despite Lestat's desperate pleas for me to come to him. There, in the far corner, was the coffin where he slept, the lacquer peeling from the wood, half covered with piles of yellow newspapers. And bones lay in the corners, picked clean except for bits and tufts of fur. But Lestat had his dry hands on mine now, drawing me towards him and towards the warmth, and I could see the tears welling in his eyes. And only when his mouth was stretched in a strange smile of desperate happiness that was near to pain did I see the faint traces of the old scars. How baffling and awful it was, this smooth-faced, shimmering, immortal man bent and rattled and whining like a crone.
"Yes, Lestat," I said softly. "I've come to see you."
I pushed his hand gently, slowly away, and moved towards the baby, who was crying desperately now from fear as well as hunger. As soon as I lifted it up and loosened the covers, it quieted a little, and then I patted it and rocked it. Lestat was whispering to me now in quick, half-articulated words I couldn't understand, the tears streaming down his cheeks, the young vampire at the open window with a look of disgust on his face and one hand on the window latch, as if he meant at any minute to bolt.
"So you're Louis," said the young vampire. This seemed to increase Lestat's inexpressible excitement, and he wiped frantically at his tears with the hem of his robe.
A fly lit on the baby's forehead, and I involuntarily gasped as I pressed it between two fingers and dropped it dead to the floor. The child was no longer crying. It was looking up at me with extraordinary blue eyes, dark blue eyes, its round face glistening from the heat, and a smile played on its lips, a smile that grew brighter like a flame. I had never brought death to anything so young, so innocent. And I was aware of this now as I held the child with an odd feeling of sorrow, stronger even than that feeling which had come over me in the Crow Royale, and rocking the child gently, I pulled the young vampire's chair to the fire and sat down.
"Don't try to speak. It's all right," I said to Lestat, who dropped down gratefully into his chair and reached out to stroke the lapels of my coat with both hands.
"But I'm so glad to see you," he stammered through his tears. "I've dreamed of your coming, he said,
and then he grimaced as if he were feeling a pain he couldn't identify. And again the fine map of scars appeared for an instant. He was looking off, his hand up to his ear as if he meant to cover it to defend himself from some terrible sound.
"I didn't," he started,
and then he shook his head, his eyes clouding as he opened them wide, strained to focus them.
"I didn't mean to let them do it, Louis. I mean that Santiago, that one, you know, he didn't tell me what they planned to do."
"That's all past, Lestat," I said.
"Yes, yes,"
he nodded vigorously.
"Past.
She should never... Why, Louis, you know... And he was shaking his head, his voice seeming to gain in strength, to gain a little in resonance with his effort. She should have never been one of us, Louis. And he rapped his sunken chest with his fist as he said, us, again softly. She. It seemed then that she had never existed, that she had been some illogical, fantastical dream that was too precious and too personal for me ever to confide in anyone. And too long gone. I looked at him, I stared at him, and tried to think, yes, the three of us together. Don't fear me, Lestat, I said as though talking to myself. I bring you no harm.
You've come back to me, Louis, he whispered in that thin, high-pitched voice. You've come home again to me, Louis, haven't you?
And again he bit his lip and looked at me desperately. No, Lestat. I shook my head. He was frantic for a moment, and again he commenced one gesture and then another, and finally sat there with his hands over his face in a paroxysm of distress. The other vampire, who was studying me coldly, asked, Have you come back to him? No, of course not, I answered. And he smirked, as if this was as he expected, that everything fell to him again, and he walked out onto the porch. I could hear him there, very near, waiting. I only wanted to see you, Lestat, I said. But Lestat didn't seem to hear me. Something else had distracted him, and he was gazing off, his eyes wide, his hands hovering near his ears. Then I heard it also. It was a siren. And as it grew louder, his eyes shut tight against it, and his fingers covered his ears, and it grew louder and louder, coming up the street from downtown. Lestat, I said to him, over the baby's cries, which rose now in the same terrible fear of the siren, but his agony obliterated me. His lips were drawn back from his teeth in a terrible grimace of pain. Lestat, it's only a siren, I said to him stupidly. And then he came forward out of the chair and took hold of me and held tight to me, and, despite myself, I took his hand. He bent down, pressing his head against my chest and holding my hand so tight that he caused me pain. The room was filled with the flashing red light of the siren, and then it was going away.
"Louis, I can't bear it. I can't bear it," he growled through his tears. "Help me, Louis. Stay with me."
"But why are you afraid?" I asked. "Don't you know what these things are?" And as I looked down at him, as I saw his yellow hair pressed against my coat, I had a vision of him from long ago. That tall, stately gentleman in the swirling black cape, with his head thrown back, his rich, flawless voice singing the lilting air of the opera from which we'd only just come. His walking stick tapping the cobblestones in time with the music, his large, sparkling eye catching the young woman who stood by, enrapt, so that a smile spread over his face as the song died on his lips. And for one moment, that one moment when his eye met hers, all evil seemed obliterated in that flush of pleasure, that passion for merely being alive. Was this the price of that involvement? A sensibility shocked by change, shriveling from fear. I thought quietly of all the things I might say to him, how I might remind him that he was immortal, that nothing condemned him to this retreat save himself, and that he was surrounded with the unmistakable signs of inevitable death. But he did not say these things, and I knew that I would not. It seemed the silence of the room rushed back around us, like a dark sea that the siren had driven away. The flies swarmed on the festering body of a rat, and the child looked quietly up at me as though my eyes were bright baubles, and his dimpled hand closed on the finger that I poised above its tiny petal mouth. Lestat had risen, straightened, but only to bend over and slink into the chair.
"You won't stay with me," he sighed.
But then he looked away and seemed suddenly absorbed.
"I wanted to talk to you so much," he said.
That night I came home to the Rue Royale, I only wanted to talk to you." He shuddered violently, eyes closed, his throat seeming to contract. It was as if the blows I'd struck him then were falling now. He stared blindly ahead, his tongue moistening his lip, his voice low, almost natural. "I went to Paris after you." "What was it you wanted to tell me?" I asked. "What was it you wanted to talk about?" I could well remember his mad insistence in the Théâtre des Vampires. I hadn't thought of it in years. No, I had never thought of it. And I was aware that I spoke of it now with great reluctance. But he only smiled at me, an insipid, near-apologetic smile, and shook his head. I watched his eyes fill with a soft, bleary despair. I felt a profound, undeniable relief. "But you will stay," he insisted. "No," I answered. "And neither will I," said that young vampire from the darkness outside, and he stood for a second in the open window looking at us. Lestat looked up at him and then sheepishly away, and his lower lip seemed to thicken and tremble. "Close it, close it," he said, waving his finger at the window. Then a sob burst from him, and covering his mouth with his hand, he put his head down and cried. The young vampire was gone. I heard his steps moving fast on the walk, heard the heavy chink of the iron gate. And I was alone with Lestat, and he was crying. It seemed a long time before he stopped, and during all that time I merely watched him. I was thinking of all the things that had passed between us. I was remembering things which I supposed I had completely forgotten. And I was conscious then of that same overwhelming sadness which I'd felt when I saw the place in the Rue Royale where we had lived. Only, it didn't seem to me to be a sadness for Lestat, for that smart, gay vampire who used to live there then. It seemed a sadness for something else, something beyond Lestat that only included him and was part of the great, awful sadness of all the things I'd ever lost, or loved, or known. It seemed then I was in a different place, a different time, and this different place and time was very real, and it was a room where the insects had hummed as they were humming here, and the air had been close and thick with death and with a spring perfume. And I was on the verge of knowing that place, and knowing with it a terrible pain, a pain so terrible that my mind veered away from it, said, "No, don't take me back to that place." And suddenly it was receding, and I was with Lestat here now. Astonished, I saw my own tear fall onto the face of the child. I saw it glisten on the child's cheek, and I saw the cheek become very plump with the child's smile. It must have been seeing the light in the tears. I put my hand to my face and wiped at the tears that were in fact there and looked at them in amazement.
"But Louis," Lestat was saying softly, "how can you be as you are? How can you stand it?"
He was looking up at me, his mouth in that same grimace, his face wet with tears.
"Tell me, Louis, help me to understand. How can you understand it all? How can you endure?"
And I could see by the desperation in his eyes and the deeper tone which his voice had taken that he too was pushing himself towards something that for him was very painful, towards a place where he hadn't ventured in a long time. But then, even as I looked at him, his eyes appeared to become misty, confused. And he pulled the robe up tight, and shaking his head he looked at the fire. A shudder passed through him, and he moaned. "I have to go now, Lestat," I said to him. I felt weary, weary of him and weary of this sadness. And I longed again for the stillness outside, that perfect quiet to which I'd become so completely accustomed. But I realized, as I rose to my feet, that I was taking the little baby with me. Lestat looked up at me now with his large, agonized eyes and his smooth, ageless face.
"But you'll come back? You'll come to visit me? Louis,
he said. I turned away from him, hearing him calling after me, and quietly left the house. When I reached the street, I looked back, and I could see him hovering at the window as if he were afraid to go out. I realized he had not gone out for a long, long time, and it occurred to me then that perhaps he would never go out again.